Blog Talk Radio.
And good afternoon from Fairfax, Virginia, where it is a rainy, dark, and thunderstormy day. We're under a tornado watch until 5 p.m. Eastern, so what better time to go and talk about military matters on Military Monday? My name is John Gresham. I am your host, and we're going to spend the next hour talking about book publishing, because let's face it, I'm an author, as are many of the people I have on the show. People who know about military matters frequently are authors and journalists, and it helps that we have them to explain the very complex details of the daily world of the military to us. We're going to talk today about a particular segment of military publishing, and that is the rather unique and special area of reference books. Now you say, what do we mean by reference books? Well, I'm literally talking about those big, thick, almost encyclopedic works which go ahead and provide you massive amounts of data on weapon systems, organizations, people, and that certainly are never going to make the New York Times or Amazon top 100 publishing lists, but on the other hand, are incredibly necessary to people like myself. One of the best is a book that comes out every few years from one of my favorite publishers, the U.S. Naval Institute Press over in Annapolis, Maryland. This organization, which of course, as you would guess, is associated with the U.S. Naval Institute, actually is headquartered on the grounds of the Naval Academy, and they put out specialty books, although it's worth noting that they were the first publisher of The Hunt for Red October, which was published by the late Tom Clancy back in 1984. But our guest today is a somewhat younger and more vibrant man. His name is Eric Wertheim. He is a well-known systems and military analyst here in the D.C. metro area, and he is the editor of what is known as Combat Fleets of the World, which is a truly massive book. It's a large format. It's thick, like about 2.5-3 inches thick. It weighs a whole lot, and I would tell you that I have a line of these books in my bookshelf going back into the 1970s. And to go ahead and let's just talk about this, because we're going to talk not only what's in it, but also how you go and do a book like this and what is sort of the history of it. Eric, are you there, my friend?
Yes, thank you very much for that very kind introduction.
So, you're very welcome. And I guess we're going to start a little bit by talking about the history of this book, because this book has a history. This book is part of publishing history. And let's start by talking even before it. Where did the idea of large reference books on navies come from originally? How far back do they run, really?
Well, Combat Fleets of the World originally started as a French book called Floats de Combat, and it goes and traces its history back to 1897, according to the references I've seen. And by way of comparison, our primary English competitor, Jane's Fighting Ships, traces its history back to 1898. So actually, Floats de Combat is 1 year older, according to the references I have seen, and started off as a source of where you can find information on every ship in every navy of the world. And since then, every couple of years, a new edition comes out, and it is starting around 1976. It was translated into English for the very first time by the Naval Institute Press. And it really came about because there is such a need by the navies of the world, the media of the world, the enthusiasts of the world, to really have a good snapshot and a good reference about showing this is what is a snapshot of today's world navy and military scene. And that has evolved over the years so that the book today is far, far bigger than it was even in 1976 with the first English language edition, and which started really as just a translation, a word-for-word translation of the French edition. that then was eventually transferred over to my colleague, A.D. Baker III, who, of course, did a marvelous job with the book up through the 1980s and 1990s. And he decided in 2002 that it was really time to step aside and retire. And that is when the Naval Institute called me and asked if I was interested.
Now, this is not exactly a crowded field, as it were, in terms of competition. You obviously mentioned there is Janes Fighting Ships, which is still produced by the Janes Publishing Group. There's also an excellent pocket-sized book called Wires, Warships of the World, which you have to be able to read German to understand, but is sort of a universal field guide. And then there's combat fleets. Are there any others out there that we don't generally talk about in maybe Chinese or Arabic or any other languages?
Well, there is. I've heard of an Italian version. I do not get that Italian version. I have not seen it, but I have heard that there are variants of an Italian version. I have not seen a version that's published in Asia, or nor have I heard of it. I'm in contact with sources and publishers all over the world, and from the sales of combat fleets around the world, you can see that it appears that combat fleets is really one of, if not the primary source that these people around the world use for reference on the world's navies. And actually, as you did the introduction, you said this is a book that would never make the Amazon 100. Amazingly, this a few weeks back, the book was released on August 15th, and it was number 38 under Naval References. So I'm very proud of that, that it's doing very well in terms of Naval References. Of course, for a very expensive book like this, it's quite a surprise.
Indeed. And let's quickly, you know, caveat this so the people understand. This is not a cheap book. This is not an e-book which you're going to buy for $5.95 off of the Amazon or Kindle download list. How much is this, and how does that compare with your competitors?
Yeah, the list price of Combat Fleets is now $295, but it's on sale for various places in on Amazon at www.usni.org for less than $180. That's a very, very big discount. So I've seen it. Generally, you can get it in a lot of different places for less than $200. That compares to about $1,200 for Janes Fighting Ships. And, of course, the Wires, the German version, has not had an edition release since 2008. So really the only games in town, especially for English speakers, are Janes, which is about $1,200, and Combat Fleets, which is now running in the $200 range. That's a big difference in price, and I think any of your readers will be delighted if they decide that to put the two side by side. You'll really see. I think Combat Fleets will be more than stand up to any of the competition.
You mentioned A.D. Baker, who is obviously a mutual friend and colleague of ours. What did he do? You know, obviously there was the translation effort from Flotte de Combat in the late 1970s. How did he evolve the book between that time and when they handed it off to you in 2002 as editor?
Yes, it's actually an amazing story, because it started out, as I suggested, as a word-for-word kind of translation. And little by little, the book became more and more of what Dave imagined the book to be. And it expanded slowly by little over the years during the height of the Cold War, for instance, and the Reagan buildup. And there were more pictures that were able to be put in, more details, and most importantly, more remarks and data on and just kind of comments on budgetary information. All these kind of things started to happen. The other thing is that aircraft and weapon systems started to be included, because, of course, in the old days, very old days, they didn't have missiles. So you just said what the gun systems were. And, of course, back in 1897 and early 1900s, there were not aircraft. So that was not an issue either. That's a very, very big difference about my book. As Combat Fleets has evolved through Dave Baker and to myself, we have started to include all the naval weapons and all the naval aircraft in inventory. That is a very, very big difference between us and any other naval reference book. It is really, really amazing. So when you look at a country, you know, I'm just opening to a random page like Japan, you will find very useful information on, for instance, I'll walk you through a sample entry. So, for instance, you would find, first you open up and you find the data on the personnel. And then you would find the organization information, so how the fleet is organized. Then you would find where its bases are. Then you get the information on all the naval aviation assets and the number of personnel assigned to the Naval Aviation Force and the types and numbers of aircraft that are used, whether it's P-3 Orions or anything like that. And then I go into the kind of information like naval radars. Now, if you go to a country like France, for instance, where they have a lot of weapon systems that they design and build themselves, you'll see that I not only touch on the specific data for the aircraft, but I also go into the radars, the air-to-air missiles, the surface-to-air missiles, and I give the detailed information and the history so that this is a one-of-a-kind, all-inclusive reference on navies, coast guards, all that stuff. We even include numbers for Marine Corps. And the reason we do that is it's the only source that does that, number one. And number two, it kind of showcases how we have evolved, how the book has evolved from the 1800s, late 1800s, into the 20th century, and now the 21st century. Each time we're able to tweak it a little bit and kind of refine based on what readers and users want to have.
And let's talk about that. I mean, this is, as we said, not a small book. I mean, I don't remember if I looked at the actual page count. Do you have the page count in this on this monster?
It's over 1,000 pages. I'll tell you that.
Okay, and these are big pages. This is a big format. 11 by 17.
Yes, and it's got over 4,000 photographs, dozens, scores of very, very detailed line drawings. That's each edition, one of the areas I've been focusing on most recently has been improvements to the way that the line drawings have been done. So we have some tremendous artists and draftsmen who are doing really, really incredible work, getting the details and working with ship designers and all this kind of stuff to get the most accurate picture of what the ships look like from different views and what the weapon systems are fitted to the ships and where they are specifically fitted. It's quite amazing. This edition I'm very, very happy with.
What are some of the other things that you've done in this edition that are new and different? And I'm going to just start by saying, you know, maybe it's that I'm a bibliophile at heart, but I love the new binding on it. It's definitely an improvement over past years. And let's face it, folks, with a big book like this, you need a really tough binding.
Oh, absolutely. I remember seeing some early versions, and it's tough to find a good balance between cost and sturdiness for a book like this. They did a masterful job. I'm really happy with how the production department worked things. And this was part of the evolution. You know, when the Naval Institute first approached me, when A.D. Baker, who I call Dave, and most of his friends know him as Dave Baker, decided to retire. They did not have a replacement yet in mind, and I was at a conference, and the CEO of the Naval Institute, whose name was Tom Marfiak then, retired Admiral Marfiak, put his arm around me and jokingly said, "Eric, the next editor of Combat Fleets of the World." And I had no idea what he was talking about. And then a couple other people started saying this to me. And it turned out that they did have someone in mind, and it was me. Now, I had no idea. So after that conference, which was at the Naval Academy, I called up the Naval Institute, who I've been working with since I was, of course, a teenager, working on books and magazines with them. And they said to me, well, I asked them what this was about, and they said to me, well, there's a very short list of who we would like to take over the book, and you're very high on that list. And I told them right away, I'm not sure I can do this. I may know a lot of things, but this amount of data that's required for this amount of expertise is so It seemed insurmountable. And they said, would you like us to take your name off the list? We'd really like you to keep it on just to see where it goes. And I said, well, fine, just leave it on the list and I'll see where this goes. Well, they had a bit of a selection committee, and in the end they decided that they wanted me to take over. And after much thought and debate, I decided, and conversations with the publishers and the director of the publishing company, I decided that it was really where my career was going and where they wanted it to go.
In other words, you didn't volunteer, you were drafted.
Yes, and I had enough respect for the people who chose me, and I didn't, number one, want to let them down, and number two, I figured, you know what, I might not think that I have the ability to do this yet, but obviously, if I respect them and they're telling me they think they're the one I'm the one that they want to do the book, then maybe I really should take their word for it. And it was that first edition, I'll tell you, that was a scary prospect putting that together, because Dave Baker had retired and I was very much on my own for that first one. And that was probably one of the scariest times I had. There was a lot going on and trying to figure out how to put a book like this together. So thankfully, the publisher said, let's have one extra year. It used to be every other year. And they said, it was 2002. I said, eventually we decided to publish this one in 2005, it became the 2005-2006 edition. And that you've seen around the internet, that's a big blue edition. You probably have it on your shelf, and it did very, very well, and I'm happy with it. Of course, I was reluctant to change too much because that was my very first edition, and I wanted to leave things as close to how it was before, because I figured you don't mess with excellence. And little by little, as I gained more confidence and listened and talked to readers, I started tweaking little things as the book through the years became more of my own. And last year, of course, it was 10 years since I took over. Now it's been 11 years since I've been working on combat fleets.
And if you'd like to talk to Eric or myself, please feel free to call in. Our call-in number is 347-945-7246. Again, that's area code 347-945-7246. Eric, let's start at the very beginning here, back when you were given the job. I mean, did Dave leave you like a big box of pages and stuff? I mean, did you have any resources left over from when you took over from Dave? Or was this the update, did you start on your own and just take it from there?
No, the good thing about it was that Dave did say, okay, here's a CD with what I turned into the press. The press gave me stuff, and they said, this is where we are. This book is the Naval Institute Guide, so they kind of own all the rights. And as the Naval Institute Guide to Combat Fleets of the World, they had the manuscript. So I started off with the 2002-2003 manuscript, and I had to figure out how it was best to get this information. Then the next thing that Dave turned over to me, which was very, very valuable, was the list of his primary contributors and where he got some of his information.
That has to be solid gold for a guy in the reference book business.
That was exactly what that was. It was primary contributors, and most importantly, more than contributors, it was photographers, the naval photographers who supply me the information so that I can do the analysis. Very often, the way that I do the analysis for combat fleets is I get thousands and thousands of photos often every month. And what I do is I look at these photos, compare them to the photos that I have, and I'm able to say, look at this. This system has a new radar on it. This system has a new new missile system on it. I have magnifying glass and bright lights, and I sit under there for hours and hours looking at these photos. Of course, there's also the contributors or shipbuilders or the information where you get stuff that's open source, and I kind of pour over that during the courses of the days and the weeks. And learning that trade, learning how to identify the differences in ships' systems from one year to the next, those were the kind of things, gaining confidence to be able to do that was probably the most challenging. The other part is putting together a book that is so very large and starting, for instance, it'd be like driving across the coast of the United States and having to figure out within a month period when you're going to arrive at your location. Because everything, it's a whole team effort. So the way it works is I constantly work to keep as much data as I can up to date and file the photos away and update the manuscript and keep things going. And then, of course, there's a real push when I'm ready. I sign a contract for the new edition. And the way it works is I start on the A's and I get the data in and insert and look for the best photos and the new photos and the new drawings who I've had artists draw up. And then I go through the A chapters, and I go through every single possible edit and all the changes, and I compare to the last edition, I compare to my competitors, and I go through and I get each entry, make sure that it's as up-to-date and accurate as possible, and then I go to the B's and C's and D's, and I work my way through the alphabet while new stuff is coming, and the nice thing is I'm able to usually insert that stuff. Now, the trouble is, so what's happening is I'm sending the A's and B's and C's and D's in, and that goes to the publisher. They start proofreading. They start having copy editors go through it. And they start working. Once it goes to the copy editors, it goes to the layout people, and they work the layout stuff. And I go through it with the copy editors and the people that say, well, let's change this style and let's do this and we'll start doing that. By that time, I might be up to the J's or K's. And then the J's and K's go, and I work my way to the disease. At this point, I'm getting the first proofs back for the A's, B's, and C's. So we're putting updated photos in there and making modernizations. And the whole cycle goes through, and by the end, eventually I get all the latest proofs and all the stuff, and it's ready to go. I give my okay to the publisher, and eventually it comes out as a book.
I guess one question I have, and this is certainly, you know, having done some fairly large and extensive, you know, data-oriented books myself in my past, do you use computerized databases to keep the data in order, or do you have a card file? What do you do to maintain and update your data as you move along between editions?
Well, what I do is I have digital files on my computer where I have updates on each of the things, and I keep a running tally on changes for stuff that needs to be done. Of course, there's always going to be new things coming in, so I keep that done through a file system on digitally. And then I also have a hard copy where, for some of the things, when people, there are, of course, still old-fashioned photographers that use film and send me their stuff, and I keep those filed away. And then when it's time to go through a chapter, I go through and make sure that everything I have is up to date. And that's the real work there. That's getting those chapters ready is really the work that's required. And making sure the photos are up to date and you know, saying, oh, I'm going to try and get a better photo for this. Getting the new drawings in, all that kind of stuff is really a very time-consuming labor of love, if you could say, because it's very fun. The difficulty is it's always up against time limits, of course, against deadlines. And the challenge is there's always the possibility that if I had more time, I can make it even better. But, of course, the longer I wait, the longer the customer has to wait and the readers have to wait, and I have to find that compromise. And so that's always the issue. And, of course, very often things like marketing and sales from the publisher fall into it, and they might say, we want this book to come out 6 months later than you planned because we think sales and information will be better then, so let's do that. And that kind of stuff happens. They want to do this for budgetary reasons as a 2013 book instead of a 2012 book, and usually that allows me to keep it updated even a little bit more. That's what happened with this edition. It was originally supposed to come out in 2012, and they decided for marketing and other reasons they wanted to come out in mid-2013. So it was kind of nice because I just took the extra 6 months and made sure all the kind of dotted all the T's and dotted the I's and crossed the T's and made sure then that we had stuff in there all the way up to April and early spring of 2013, which was really remarkable. And I feel very fortunate that the press allowed me to have those updates in there all the way. You'll see stuff from March 2013 in there and even a couple things from April.
So this thing is a living, breathing document, and basically you have to stop it at some point, take a snapshot of all everything in it, and that becomes the book.
That's exactly what happens. Is I do my best to keep things up to date, and then I do a real push at the end to make sure that every last bit is ready for as close to perfection as I can get it, and then it goes to the publisher, and that's the book. That's what I have as of that date, essentially. And then I start work already on the next edition.
Which you're already working on.
Absolutely. I'm already starting and thinking about the 17th edition. I'm already getting new photos in. And it's fun, although, of course, I need a break every now and then.
I hate to ask this question because I never want to actually admit what my working space looks like. But what does the working space of a reference book editor look like at your home where you do this work?
Well, I can tell you I have one room that when I'm working on the book is an absolute, it looks like a bomb went off in there. So there is one room that is kind of my office, and that's where I do a lot of different stuff. So when I'm actually picking out photo layouts, that tends to kind of spread and creep into my entire house, so that after a while, the living room and the bedrooms are filled with pictures, stacks of pictures where I sort them for, like, if I'm going through France, you know, I'll have, okay, the helicopters stack here, the fighter jets stack here. Then I go to the surface ships, the destroyers, the frigates. Then I have the submarines. And each one I have to go through as I pick different views to make sure that I get the port view, the starboard view, the overhead view, different things to make sure. And figuring all the layout stuff, doing that. And, of course, with bright lights, magnifying glass to make sure I got the right stuff and all that kind of thing. It's very... isolating at times when you're really working against deadlines. As an author, I'm sure you know.
Oh, God, yes. And, of course, at the same time, throughout the entire process, you're doing a monthly column for U.S. Naval Institute Proceedings, occasional articles for other people, including my own publisher, Defense Media Network. I mean, this is not the only gig you've got. And, of course, you have a regular day job as a systems analyst here for a local Beltway Bandit. So this is a busy life you have.
What I do is each month, of course, I stay busy and I do my annual World Navies in Review each March. So in March, I actually write the summary of what's going on in the world's navies. And that's the biggest article that's published each year by one person in the Proceedings magazine. And it runs... between 8 and 10,000 words usually, closer to 10,000 words often, dozen pictures. It's really a very good, I think, summary of what's going on in the world navies today. Then, to keep the book updated, is my monthly column that runs in Proceedings magazine as Combat Fleets of the World each month. And that has three items that we're talking about that have impacted the world's navies or changed them. It's kind of an update to the book. So, for instance, in next month, so I just finished the November column, and that's going to cover new hovercraft that have been purchased by Colombia, new riverine boats that have been transferred to the Philippines, and a new upgrade that has just been signed, a contract has just been signed for French maritime patrol aircraft. So that gives an idea of the kind of stuff I monitor. So all those things together kind of help make keep me up to date and force me to keep working on the book, even when I'm a little worn out from it. But the fun thing is, as you know, with people who really enjoy what they do, there's a very fine line between work and play sometimes. I really enjoy it all.
Excellent. And with that, and you just made a wonderful segue into where I want to go next, which is, what is new in the world's navies that we're going to see in this edition of Combat Fleets? Let's talk a little bit about what are the trends you see worldwide, if any. Let's start with worldwide trends.
Sure. Well, I think one of the biggest things we're seeing is a lot of production and construction of amphibious ships. These very large ships can be built for, of course, landing marines, but also they're very useful for humanitarian disasters, troop transports, any kind of logistics operations, any kind of thing like that. And you'll see the crises that are happening in a lot of ways in the world around Asia, where you see a lot of kind of fights over our islands and contested areas. These kind of amphibious ships can play an important role in those. So I think you're seeing a lot of amphibious ships that are entering service. You're seeing the other thing is that steel is relatively cheap compared to electronics. And an amphibious ship is a very large ship. You know, we're talking 20,000 tons for a lot of these cases, you know, 15 to 20,000 tons. In some cases, even larger, like for the Australian Canberra class, we're talking 27,000 tons. Those are very large ships. And so they're relatively cheap, though, compared to the electronics that we would talk about in like an Aegis destroyer or something like that. So the steel is cheaper than the electronics very often, and that's one of the reasons you see these very large ships being built, because they're impressive. They are great for power projection and prestige, but they are also useful across the spectrum for landing troops, for humanitarian assistance, for all different kinds of stuff. So I think we're seeing a very big increase in amphibious ships. We're also seeing a very big increase in submarines across the world. So it used to be that submarines and modern underwater warfare systems were really the domain of the top navies in the world. And that's been changing a lot. And you have countries all around the world now that are able to invest in very, very advanced submarines. In some cases, they're fitted with, we're talking about diesel submarines, of course, were fitted with air-independent propulsion systems, which allows them to stay underwater for extended periods of time. Now, nuclear-powered submarines are still the domain, the exclusive domain for the most part of the world powers. You could kind of think of the UN Security Council. Those are the countries for the most part that have nuclear submarines. Those are the ones that need to operate far from their home waters. But for countries and navies that operate in their home waters, we're seeing a very powerful advance in the capabilities of the submarine forces. And this is very challenging for a lot of the countries like the United States to deal with. We're also seeing that surface ships in some ways are increasing in the types of patrol ships that we're seeing. So, for instance, a lot of countries like the Netherlands, they're not necessarily investing in highly advanced, expensive ships. They're starting to look also to supplement their advanced ships. They're looking at lower technology levels of patrol ships. So these are quite large ships, maybe 3,500 tons kind of thing, 2,000 tons in that range. They're kind of like corvettes, but they don't necessarily move so fast, and they don't have a big missile armament. They're more gun-armed, and they're useful for EEZ patrol and refugee assistance and all those kind of things. So their counter-drug operations, those kind of general-purpose support ships, they're kind of like corvettes without missile systems, have also been a growth area, similar to, essentially, they're similar to like a slow version of the U.S. littoral combat ship.
Okay, and you first thing you talked about was this growth of amphibious warfare ships, and let's talk about what are the qualities that make these up. Obviously, they have the ability to go and take a lot of personnel and put them ashore and take them off. They have excellent medical and support facilities, good comms, good command and control. They usually have some sort of air capability. They have the ability to generate a lot of water, and deal with a lot of throughput of logistics. Talk about some of the recent examples of where this has proven useful. And I'll start with one that most people don't know, and that is when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans a few years back, we brought one of the largest of our amphibious ships out of the Atlantic Fleet and actually anchored it in stream in the Mississippi River right there off of New Orleans to provide helicopters, medical facilities, and other things. Go ahead and give us some examples of that.
Yeah, absolutely. The ability of these ships to help, for instance, in the after the earthquake in Japan recently, a few years back, I think it was last year, or the tsunami off Indonesia a few years back, these kind of things, you can see very large ships like this can play a very important role. The Japanese ships, amphibious ships, were quite useful and worked with the U.S. assets that were in the region to get aid to the earthquake victims. So you have the these very large 18,000-ton helicopter-carrying destroyers that the Japanese operate that were able to be used. They're really very similar to amphibious ships, even though for political reasons they don't necessarily call them that. You also have, of course, the dock landing ships, the large 13,000-ton dock landing ships that the Japanese operate that were also very, very valuable for things like the earthquake assistance and stuff like that. So that those kind of things are very, very valuable. Then you take the things like what's happening in the South China Sea, where you have countries like Japan and Korea and China kind of jockeying for position and claiming their own islands. They're very worried, I think, that one of the countries might land troops or something like that. All of these amphibious ships allows the maneuverability to do that, to seize these islands as they need to just in the same way how we think of Marines in the Pacific landing on beaches. So they can do that. They operate quite a number of helicopters very often. Some of them even operate fixed-wing, short takeoff and landing aircraft. And they're very powerful ships, and they have the cover of being able to be used for peacetime operations, humanitarian assistance, and they don't raise any eyebrows, while, of course, they have just as many, if not more, military applications. And we saw this, for instance...
Let's talk about that, because we've seen a genuine explosion of carrier production around the world, not just aircraft, but also helicopter carriers. And it's kind of surprising some of the people who are buying and building these things. Give us some examples. For example, in Asia, there's, if not a race for aircraft carriers, there sure is one hell of an escalating force out there.
Oh, absolutely. You have China, which just recently commissioned their first aircraft carrier, which was built on the hull of a Russian ship. And then you have India, which is also just launched their very first locally built aircraft carrier, their very own aircraft carrier, and they are also working on improving and updating another aircraft carrier based on a Russian ship. So you have both of these countries, China and India, working to expand their aircraft carrier fleet. And you have a country like Japan, which does not want to come out and say they have aircraft carriers, but they are working on a new 24,000-ton, 248-meter helicopter-carrying destroyers, which essentially could carry up to 14 helicopters. And these can... You know, some people are calling them aircraft carriers. Some of them are calling them helicopter carrier destroyers officially. There's all different names for them, but it's raising a lot of eyebrows. And because these are, in many ways, the ability to project power. You know, you have aircraft carriers, countries like Italy, which now has two aircraft carriers. And, of course, you have France, which operates the only other, nuclear, U.S., and France operate nuclear carriers, and of course Russia has their Kuznetsov, and which is also a full-size aircraft carrier as well. And so those kind of things. There's also a big difference, like I said, between the full-size carriers, which are operated by the U.S., France, Russia, and now China and India. Are entering the game. And, of course, the United Kingdom also has now invested. They took a strategic pause, and they said, in order for us to have a carrier in the future, we have to sacrifice our carriers today. So for about 10 years now, they will not be operating an aircraft carrier. They have gotten rid of all their Harriers, and they are invested fully now in their two new aircraft carriers that are due to enter service in the next decade, the Queen Elizabeth class, and those are very large full-deck carriers to operate the Joint Strike Fighter.
Impressive. And let's talk a little bit about a few specific navies real quick. We hear a lot about China building heavily. How big a building program do they have for their navy, and is it really that big, or are they just building onesie-twosies of very good ships?
They are kind of experimenting, the Chinese, but they are they seem to be really, really working on their blue water capability, their ability to have a major navy to operate in the South China Sea, which they see as their sovereign domain. And that's a very big challenge to other Asian navies in the world because, for the most part, the world does not view the South China Sea as the sovereign domain of China. And so there's very likely to be a lot of tension in that region, and China is really bolstering their naval forces to be able to project power anywhere in that region they would like, and who knows what's going on beyond that. They do have some very, very impressive ships, and they are able to build them very, very quickly. It's very difficult to know how effective these ships actually are. They advertise, and you can see what the ships are said to be able to do. But, of course, we all know that very few plans survive contact with the enemy. So we just don't know how good these ships are very well, but we can see what their capabilities are. And from what on paper, what it looks, they look to be very good, efficient ships, and they're doing a lot of stuff. But it's just it's not easy to tell. They're also building some very, very good, what appear to be very, very good submarines, and they're really trying to expand their capability to first dominate the South China Sea, but also to be able to keep other navies, especially the United States, out of the region. That's a very, very important role for them, to dominate that region and keep the other navies of the world out.
What we call anti-access type operations.
Absolutely. They're building a very good cross-section of everything from coastal defense missiles to corvettes and destroyers and frigates and all that kind of stuff to be able to do that, plus, of course, their aircraft carriers. And in the short term, their aircraft carriers aren't likely to be able to take on the U.S., but they're able to, you know, they have a very they seem to be learning very quickly because, of course, they can learn from mistakes of previous people and previous countries that have gone through all these things. And I think they're also taking a very, very aggressive approach to naval operations. They're very, very aggressive in the way they're developing their Navy and the way they're employing it.
How are the Russians doing? What are our old friends, the Russians, up to these days? And are they getting any traction towards rebuilding their fleet back to their Cold War glory?
Well, they went through a very tough time the past 20 years, you could say, and they are really looking to, as you said, return to their former glory. They've had mixed success on this, but there are some interesting stories about this. One of the most interesting stories is that after they the war with Georgia a few years back, they realized that they were in dire need of amphibious ships, that they were not able to operate effectively with their amphibious fleet, because one of the problems that's happened with Russia is that their navy, though large, has in many ways stagnated. And so they were not able to get these ships that they needed out to be able to do what they needed when they needed to do it. And so because of that, they decided that they needed new amphibious ships, these large amphibious ships. But they also saw the limitations of their own shipbuilding industry. And this is what's so fascinating. What they did was they went around the world and said to foreign shipbuilders, we would like to buy a foreign amphibious ship. A lot of countries were not interested in selling it to the Russians because they were a little worried about what they would do with it. But the French decided that for financial reasons and it was worth the risk, and they sold two of their Mistral-class helicopter-carrying amphibious ships, their 20,000-ton, 210-meter amphibious ships to the Russians for use. And there was a lot of discussion and concern in NATO about this.
Listeners who might not be familiar with what we're talking about, these are sort of smaller, scaled-down versions of the big America-class landing helicopter dock ships that we are constructing right now down on the Gulf Coast at Huntington Ingalls. They're very good ships. The French are finding them outstanding vessels. And the feeling is that by the time the Russians build out the two units in their yards, they're going to have a very nice force of ships that can go anywhere and project a lot of capability.
Absolutely, and I think one of the differences you'll see between these and the America class is the America class can only operate helicopters. It cannot actually operate air cushion landing craft or LCMs in the docking well. This was a very hotly debated thing with the Marines, and they decided that in the future, the U.S. Marines, they do want to have this capability and keep this. The French ships do have that capability, as opposed to the U.S. to America class that do not have that capability.
And so since we've just bounced up against the United States Navy, let's talk about the world's largest and most capable Navy. Or is it? What is the current state of the U.S. fleet from your point of view?
Yes, by far the U.S. Navy is still the most powerful Navy in the world by quite a wide margin. Now, with budget cuts, of course, that does hit that makes some real challenges. What makes a world Navy is not so much how many ships it has, but how capable and operationally effective these ships and weapons are. So, for instance, if there's a crisis anywhere in the world, can a Navy go from a standing start, essentially, to, you know, from standing still to where it needs to go right off? Is it ready to do that? And really, very few countries have navies that are able to do that. For the most part, the U.S. fleet is able to do that, and that's what makes it such a world power. If tomorrow there is an emergency and the Navy needs to go somewhere, it can do it. Other countries are just not able to do it in the same way, and that's really what makes the U.S. Navy so powerful and so capable. At the drop of a hat, they can go where they need to go and project power in a way that dominates the region. No other Navy can do that. Now, of course, that's what Russia and China are trying to do. The only other country, one country that can do that very well but on a very small level, is France. France has one large aircraft carrier, two very, very capable destroyers that they recently commissioned. They have some older destroyers, but their Forbin class of destroyers is very, very good. And they have Rafael with their aircraft carriers. And they have nuclear-powered submarines, and they have frigates that are capable, and they're building new forces. So I think France is another navy that's very capable of going where it needs to go. Of course, a lot of the more modern NATO navies have that ability. So you have the United Kingdom, which has really cut back. It, as I said before, does not have aircraft carriers anymore, but it's able to go where it needs to go. You have other countries like the Netherlands, which takes active roles in Africa Partnership Station and things like that to travel all around the world. And you have other countries, you know, Italy, of course, and while Spain recently got rid of its aircraft carrier, it is doing its best to keep its forces afloat. And then you have countries like Japan. Now, Japan is very, very, very good locally in Asia. They are not designed because of their constitution to project power, but they are very, very good. Arguably, many people could say the best defensive navy in the world.
As we look at the world today, you get a better look at it than almost anybody I know inside or out of the government. Is there any prospect for a large naval conflict, or are people building navies primarily to provide capability, project power, and just keep a wary eye on their neighbors?
Well, I think that as you see the way that navies operate, navies are very different than armies and air forces, and navies have a very, very important role during peacetime as well as wartime. And so when you have a navy in peacetime, it's just as important as it is during wartime, and it's just as busy oftentimes, so that during the Cold War often the navies would argue the same stuff that we are doing now is what we'd be doing in a wartime. The only difference is we'd be firing live bullets and things like that. They are out there doing what they do. So, for instance, take the counter-piracy operations off the Horn of Africa. These are examples of the navies doing what they're doing. Even though this isn't a full-time, a full-fledged war, they are still deterring pirates, capturing pirates, and protecting global commerce. That's what navies in many ways are designed to do, and they do that just as importantly in peacetime. And so they help prevent counterterrorism. They help do a lot of these things. So while you have something like a tank on the ground for the army, which is very, very important and essential in a ground war, there's not much use for it during peacetime. A warship, you can argue, is exactly the opposite. It is just as equal in peacetime as it is in wartime.
I've been talking over the past few months with a number of naval analysts, some of whom, of course, you know, and I hear more and more how they're making very real comparisons between the present situation in the maritime world with navies and the threats out there back during the late 18th century, early 19th century, the Barbary pirates, the protection of maritime sea lanes, getting commerce from one continent to another. Would you concur with this kind of a thought?
Yeah, I think that there is in many ways a naval renaissance going on in many parts of the world. And they're looking at Mahan, and they're looking at past naval historians and naval theoreticians and trying to figure out how those lessons apply to today's navies. And I think that's part of the reason we're seeing such a naval buildup in areas of the world. But it's also... you see countries, one of the things that worries me most about China is that they're looking at the way countries acted around 1900 and saying that's the route. It appears to me that they're saying to themselves that's the route to become a world power, to dominate the world. The world, however, does not operate that way anymore. And so there's a lot of risk for conflict to arise, particularly in the Asia-Pacific region, because this kind of aggression is not going to stand today, yet we're seeing that kind of thing. So what we're seeing instead is other countries, these kind of naval buildups, where you have Vietnam now buying submarines to protect their interests, and you have South Korea and Japan building up their forces because they, and even the Philippines is in the midst of their biggest defense buildup in probably their nation's history, as some people argue, because they see that if they don't, they're just going to be swept aside by the changing behavior of the Chinese fleets. And I think because of that, that's really where a lot of the tension and issues are happening in Asia right now. You see less so, you know, in South America, where navies are still very important for counterinsurgency and riverine operations and counter-drug, of course. But I think in Asia is where you see the most, the biggest chance for maritime conflict. Like you saw also even with when North Korea torpedoed the, is thought to have torpedoed the South Korean corvette Chonan a few years back. That was a very risky move that they did, a very aggressive move. And you could easily see how an act of war like that could easily result in a war.
I want to thank you for coming on and talking both about your publishing experience here and at the same time talking about your views of what's going on in the world. And I want very much to go ahead and talk about one other development here because it's one that I know is personal for both of us, and that is the death of our old friend Tom Clancy. For those who do not No, I, of course, researched and wrote 7 books with Tom, his guided tour series of nonfiction books on military units. And Eric also had some work that he did with the Clancy franchise. And Eric, I know how important Tom was to my career, and not just my career, but to guys like Larry Bond and Ralph Peters. I mean, he virtually created the techno-thriller and the whole industry that went with it. What were your observations on Tom and his impact in our business?
Absolutely, yeah. Tom Clancy really was the father of the techno thriller, and what he did during the time, you know, after, of course, Americans forget, many younger Americans, that there used to be a draft, and people who were in the military, the majority of American males served in the military. Well, once that draft ended, in a lot of ways, there became this civil-military divide, and the civilian side did not really understand or appreciate what the military side did. Tom Clancy, though he probably didn't do it on purpose, but he helped bridge that gap, and he helped give appreciation so that the civilian world finally understood and appreciated the level of technology that the military was working to and how dedicated and capable they were, and how in many ways they were real heroes and the kind of work they do. And Clancy kind of, as a civilian, you almost couldn't tell he was on the outside looking in, but he allowed the people, he shined a light on what the military did so that for things like the Gulf War, the first Gulf War in 1990-91, the public was really able to see what it was. And by reading Clancy's books, they could have seen that earlier, and the people who were reading Clancy's books, they understood it. And he really helped bridge that civil-military divide in a way that few people have.
Very true, and it's worth noting for those who never got to know him, because he was a very private man who didn't go and talk a lot to the public, partially because he was a black Irishman who, with all of the, shall we say, unedited vocabulary and qualities that being Irish provide. He was also a man who was self-made and was proud of it, but I remember of all the quotes that he is accredited with, I recall perhaps best the one which was part of the dedication for his book, The Sum of All Fears, in the early 1990s, just after the Cold War, in which he dedicated the book to all the men and women of the U.S. Armed Forces, because the noblest of ideas have always been protected by warriors. What do you think of that?
I absolutely agree. I think you could, today, after 9/11, you could make the same arguments for the first responders, and you know, you could and you saw it in some of his books, Patriot Games. You know, the how the state police responded to the Naval Academy's events, to the events at the Naval Academy in the novel. You know, and about how at the state police barracks, and about the law enforcement firefighters, the armed forces, and as a whole, I think he really shined a light on people who sacrificed their well-being and their comfort to make the world a better place and to allow people to sit in the comfort of their own homes reading his very good books.
I don't know that I could have said it a whole lot better, Eric. And with that, as we come to the end of the show, what are you up to? I mean, you earlier talked about the other things that you do. I mean, obviously, you're working on the next edition of Combat Fleets. You do a monthly column for Naval Institute, as well as the World Navy's issue every May. What else have you got in mind? Do you have any other projects that you'd like to try, or does this current workload pretty much eat up your life?
Well, that's about it. My current workload is pretty overwhelming, but at the same time, I'm very fortunate in that I can manage my own time pretty well. So you can take a good workload if you can if you're able to kind of plot your own schedule, and that's really what I do. I'm very fortunate in that I can most of the time make my own deadlines and work to keep in those. And so, you know, I feel really grateful that the people I work with are very flexible, that I'm to allow me to be so flexible. I think hopefully, you know, I'm already starting on the next edition of the book. Hopefully, I do a lot of media, of course, to do interviews for documentaries and news shows and writing in magazines. So all that kind of stuff. I try and keep busy as I know you do as well.
Yeah, it's not a simple or leisurely life by any stretch of the imagination, as so many of us have found. It's both the blessing and the curse of what Tom left us, that he gave us an opportunity to take what we love to do and make a living at it, but sometimes it's a tough living.
Yeah, it's also, though, as I've said many times, it's a labor of love, because when you work on what you so much enjoy, sometimes it's hard to stop working because it's a lot of fun.
Yes, as our friends and loved ones often have come to comment to us. Eric, thank you so much for coming on. I hope we have reason to talk to you again soon, perhaps next year when the World Navy's edition of Proceedings comes out. We can get a few comments from you. And I'm so pleased to hear that Combat Fleets is doing quite well sales-wise. You know, you don't do reference books to make money, but it sounds like this one's going to turn in a tidy little profit for Naval Institute.
I certainly hope so. As I said, I'm really proud of this Naval Institute Guide to Combat Fleets 16th edition, and thank you very much for having me on to talk about it.
And with that, folks, that's the end of today's show. We hopefully will be back next week with a talk about air power in the Iraq War 2003 edition. A lot of people don't know how extensive and busy that particular air warfare campaign was, and there's a new book, also from Naval Institute Press, which talks about it. Until then, thank you for joining us, and this is John Gresham signing off for Military Monday.